I've been thinking about it for a while, and then I'm thinking, oh, okay, yeah, if I do something on, you know, weird Australian mysteries, yeah, okay, I'm going to get a few people in Australia that might be interested. But it was something that I really did want to bring, you know, to a much wider audience.
Ladies and gentlemen!
He reported that he was abducted by a 7-foot-tall female creature, and she was clad in a marsupial hide garment. And this creature apparently grabbed at him and ran off into the bush with him and took him to a rock overhang where she was actually cooking a kangaroo leg. And of course, it's got to be remembered that for the Aborigines that lived in the area, that was just another animal that lived in the bush that they feared and respected and learnt to stay away from. But for these white settlers coming in, it was a whole different story. When the lake reappears, you'll see these fence lines going out through the water where the ground had once been bare dry. So, yeah, the water definitely comes and goes.
Weird.
That's clear for everyone to see, and nobody knows exactly where the water goes or where it comes from. I mean, there's lots of different theories, but no one's actually proven anything.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. And in keeping with the Olympic spirit, even though there's like a 100% chance you're not going to hear this during the Olympics, but I've got Olympic fever. I want to reach out internationally and do an international edition of the program here this week. And as many people who know me and listen to the program for a long time know, I'm a big, huge fan of Australia. I feel a special kinship with the place. If I could, I would go there and stay. I've never even been there, but I feel like if I went there, I wouldn't want to come back. It just sounds like such an enchanted place. And as such, we're exploring this enchanted place this week on the program. Our guest is Andrew Nicholson. He is the man behind the website WeirdAustralia.com. And what I like about WeirdAustralia.com is it collects a whole bunch of different strange and unusual stories from Australia. And it you can really tell that it's a labor of love. Andrew's not trying to push Weird Australia t-shirts on you or anything else. It's just his efforts to put these stories out. And you can just really tell that there's a real inquisitive spirit behind it and a sense of adventure. So I really like that a lot. And that's why I wanted to get him here on the program, because I enjoy reading the pieces at Weird Australia. And you can tell that they're, I don't know, I feel a kinship with Andrew as well. It's almost like he's cherry-picking the best of the best for his readers, much like we do here on BOA Audio. Welcome to the program, Andrew. I think it's going to be a really fun and enlightening conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
So I guess, you know, let's start out with the bio, the background. You know, who is Andrew Nicholson? How did you decide to, you know, kick off Weird Australia? What drew your interest into the strange and unusual?
Well, it actually goes back quite a long way. So I think from as soon as I can remember as a young kid, I was just always drawn to, the mysterious and unexplained. I loved the, UFO stories and especially the Yowie stories. After I stopped reading Little Golden books, I started reading, the Reader's Digest books on, all the unexplained phenomena. So, started at a very early age.
And then what made you decide to, because lots of the listeners out there, they read a lot, obviously, but most of them don't take the next step to sort of become a writer, if you will, or a content provider. How did you decide, I'm going to take my interest and then turn it into output for the world, I guess you could say, on the internet?
Yeah, well, I guess it's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I do actually have a writing background, so I'm actually a communications manager for one of Australia's private banks, and I started kind of writing within the financial services industry probably back in about 1995. So I do have that kind of writing background. And it's something that, I did have in the back of my mind for quite a while. And I must say, Tim, that it was actually, you were one of the inspirations for me to actually start this site because, although I'd been kind of thinking about it for a long time.
I'm laughing just because I didn't know this, so people are going to think.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
People think it's like some setup. Yeah, well, this is news to me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'd been thinking about it for a while and then I'm thinking, oh, okay. Yeah. If I do something on, weird Australian mysteries. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to get a few people in Australia that might be interested. But it was something that I really did want to bring, to a much wider audience. And I've actually been listening to, the Banal of America for, quite a few years now. I think the first show that I listened to was the, Super Volcano episode with Marie D. Jones.
Oh yeah, that's a great one, yeah.
And, I've kind of been listening ever since. And just, you've always been, willing to, talk to people from different countries and get different perspectives and, find out what's happening in other countries. And, that was one of the catalysts that made me think, well, there could be a wider audience for this stuff. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There's a huge audience for it and we're talking to him right now. Like I said, I didn't know anything about that, folks. I'm blushing like crazy here. I'm just, well, thank you, sir. I appreciate the, that I'm humbled that you, would say such things and that I could spawn such interest. Well, like I said, maybe that ties into this, kinship that I felt going into the interview because my work here, you look at all the different stuff. That's what I love about Weird Australia. You're covering UFOs, Yowies, poltergeists, bunyips, which I've never even heard of, although I think I have it in the back of my mind.
Yep.
But the name rang a bell, but you really explore that. A whole bunch of other stuff, underground bases and all kinds of things. So really love WeirdAustralia.com.
Yeah, and it's something, I would never want to be kind of regarded as, a UFO guy or a Yowie guy, because I think if you kind of get too narrow, I think in what you look at, then I think you kind of you lose that bigger perspective, and I think you can probably end up going crazy by just focusing on one element of this this pretty wacky world that we. They're into.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know how some of these folks that are super specialized don't get bored. That's what I think would happen to me.
Exactly, that's right. And then you look at some people that just, will focus on a particular case.
Oh, I know.
And then that becomes their kind of life obsession. And, that is something that I've always wanted to steer well clear of.
So. yeah, for sure. That makes both of us. Well, when we were setting up this conversation, I suggested to you that much like our friend Jason Offit, who appeared on the program earlier this season, his blog is also kind of a labor of love and collects these different stories. And I saw a real similarity between the two. So I thought it'd be a good opportunity to do a very Offit-esque conversation here on the program where I cherry pick some of the very best or weirdest stories from WeirdAustralia.com. No pun intended or, alliteration intended there. And so I guess we'll just dive into the hit list, if you will. And the first one I sent you was The Wild Hairy Man of the Blue Mountains. This is a blog post where you talk about this Yowie or this Bigfoot-like creature in the Blue Mountains. Of course, many folks who listen to the program have heard our conversation with Tony Healy, co-author of the book on the Yowie, which is a fantastic piece of work. And, folks should definitely check that out sometime if they have not heard that BOA audio episode. But you make the point in this blog post that, these Yowie reports predate the whole Bigfoot insanity or mainstream resonance that it has now, and also that you've had some pretty interesting personal experiences in the Blue Mountains where you may have almost crossed paths with the Yowie. So tell me a little bit about this blog post and, you know, tell me about these wild, hairy men of the Blue Mountains.
Yeah, well, as you said, you know, I think one of the main things that a lot of skeptics have come out and said, you know, in regards to Yowies and Bigfoot is that, well, how come we've never heard of these animals or these, you know, sightings, you know, before, say, the Patterson-Gimlin film or talk about the Yeti back in the 1950s. But there's actually been, when people first crossed over the Blue Mountains, which is a very rugged mountain range that lies just to the west of Sydney, and it covers something like 10,000 odd square kilometres of national parks and just very rugged, thick bush, and it's a huge area, and most of it is it's still unexplored. But when the mountains were first crossed back in 1813 and people started moving into the area, there's been, you know, reports of these ape-like or gorilla-like animals being seen, and they were often referred to as the wild hairy man of the bush or the Yahoo, and then later with Rex Gilroy kind of bring the animal back into our consciousness. I think back in the 1970s, it started being referred to as the Yowie. But most of the references that I found in the reports that I've looked at referred to either the Yahoo or the wild hairy man. And once I started looking into the reports, I was actually shocked at how many reports that there actually were coming in to and being reported as, you know, it's fact in newspapers and people seeing these creatures.
Oh, you jump in there. Yeah, it's interesting that it seems like the Yowie reports treated this, I mean, I'm sure they treated it as a mystery, but it was almost, there were so many of them that it sounds like maybe that, I don't know, it wasn't treated with the ridicule that it is today or would be today. It was almost like this is just an animal you encounter.
They were actually treated fairly matter-of-factly,
yeah.
And you know, a lot of these stories are dating back to the 1820s. In fact, one of the earliest stories that I could find is of a soldier in Governor Macquarie's regiment, and he was out hunting for food in the vicinity of what is today the town of Springwood in the Blue Mountains. And the story goes that while he was out hunting, he came across an ape-like animal that swung down from the trees and approached him, making threatening gestures. And apparently the soldier, shot the animal dead. Now, I guess in today's terms that we would think, oh, he's shot a Yowie.
Yeah, you know, it'd be like major news.
Exactly. But I guess back in the 1820s, to them, there would have been a lot of unknown animals out in the bush, and, you know, they would have just assumed that this was just another one of those unknown animals. And so he obviously, if the story is correct, of course, that he just left the body there to rot in the bush. I mean, given the ruggedness of the bush, it would have been pretty much impossible for him, you know, for one person to drag a body back into the, into the village anyway. But
well, it's weird. It's just a strange story. So tells you about the times in a sense that this guy, he could have, you know, what year was this?
It was around 1820, Tim.
Yeah, so, you know, almost 200 years ago. If it happened 200 years later, this guy'd be like a worldwide celebrity or something. For shooting with Bigfoot.
Exactly, that's right. Yeah. And around that 1820 time, there were, you know, quite a few stories starting to come through of this wild hairy man. And of course, it's got to be remembered that for the Aborigines that lived in the area, that was just another animal that lived in the bush that, you know, they feared and respected, and learnt to stay away from. But for these white settlers coming in, it was a whole, you know, whole different story. Around the same time, 1820, there was a report of a pioneering family that lived in a small bark hut in the bush, and one of these creatures apparently came in and peered in through the window and then dashed back off into the bush. I think one of the most interesting stories is one just a few years later where there was a young 7-year-old boy called Adam Firth, and he reported that he was abducted by a 7-foot-tall female creature, and she was clad in a marsupial hide garment. And this creature apparently grabbed Adam and ran off into the bush with him and had him look into a rock overhang, and where she was actually cooking a kangaroo leg and offered Adam part of the kangaroo leg. And
wow.
Apparently he only escaped after the creature heard dogs barking and his family shouting out to him that they were coming, you know, they were searching for him in the bush.
That's just weird, because that's a strange, sort of story, because she's talking about things that you don't attribute to the Bigfoot at all, like wearing clothes and cooking food.
Exactly, yeah, the cooking of the kangaroo leg and dressed in marsupial clothes, so, and 7 foot tall as well. So I guess, you know, you could put that down to maybe being, you know, a local Aborigine had come along and taken him, but when it's 7 foot tall, that's an Aboriginal doesn't really account for, you know, that kind of height, so.
The only explanation is that he's 7 years old, so maybe it looks 7 feet tall to him, but who knows?
Yeah, exactly, that's right. But, yeah, it's one of those interesting stories, and I guess, you know, you've got to, keep it into perspective and think that, you know, there obviously are other explanations for it.
Nope.
It's the same in the next case where we've got, in 1893, there was a shale miner at one of the little mining villages in the Blue Mountains called Glen Davis, and his name was Charles Wilson, and he went missing dead several days later. And with the condition of his body, it looked like he'd been the victim of cannibalism.
Oh, God.
And the people in the area put it down to him being attacked by the wild hairy man. So whether that's true or not, I guess it illustrates just how the people in the area at the time actually, you know, considered this to be a real creature and something to be feared.
Exactly, because if they found some dude who had been a victim of cannibalism now, they wouldn't just write it off to the Yowie. It would turn into a massive police investigation and all kinds of stuff. So it was a whole different time back then. Now, in modern times, you've had your own personal experiences in this region with potential, I wouldn't say Yowie encounters, but I guess they were kind of close, or at least close to something weird and odd. So talk about that experience that you had on a personal level.
Yeah, it was it's quite interesting. Where I live in the Blue Mountains, I live in a village, but so it's kind of a built-up area, but you're back onto, you know, very thick, rugged bush, and then that stretches for miles and miles before there's, you know, any other kind of civilization. So it's, although it's, you know, there are other houses around, and it's in a built-up area, you know, you're right in the, you are right in the bush, and it is very rugged. And so I often go for bushwalks in the area, and I was walking down this track one day, and it's only, you know, probably about 10, 15 minutes from where I live, and walking down this track with my dog and just along a normal fire trail, and there was no one else around, you know, nice, peaceful and quiet. And all of a sudden in the bush, just to the left of me, I just heard a rustling and then these three or four bang, 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 like really loud footsteps. And I knew it wasn't a kangaroo or anything, because I've heard plenty of kangaroos, you know, hop off in the bush, and you know exactly what that sounds like.
Yeah.
But these were very loud footsteps, probably three or four, and then it just stopped. And I couldn't see anything, but at the same time, I didn't want to see anything.
yeah.
So I wasn't really looking too hard. And I kind of stood there for a minute and just kind of tried to process what was happening, and then decided it was probably time to turn around and walk back out of the track. But the time I was there, I had this really strong feeling of being watched.
Yeah. Now, I got a bunch of questions about that. How did your dog react, and did you smell anything? These are two sort of things that might give us some indication of what might be going on.
Yeah, my dog was only a young pup at the time, and he didn't react, but I guess that doesn't surprise me, because around the same time, we were walking along another track one day, and I was talking to one of my friends and kind of oblivious to what was going on around me, and my dog was just out in front, and he was, I think, you know, he was about kind of six months old at the time. And both of us nearly trod on this massive python snake.
Oh, wow.
So, and this was around the same time. So he actually didn't pick up on anything, and I didn't smell anything. And I know that that is, and that's something that I was thinking that was going through my mind as well. Look, it doesn't really surprise me, because in that area, it's not like any creature would be rolling around in mud, or
yeah.
It's a very dry bush. There's a few little creeks running through it, but it's it's an animal living in that environment wouldn't be getting a lot of mud or anything on it. So I guess that didn't really surprise me, that aspect of it. But in talking about the dog, it took me a few months before I was kind of prepared to go walking back down that track again. But once I did, and my dog at this stage was, you know, obviously a little bit older, and I let him off the lead and he'd run out in front of me. But as soon as we got down to that part of the track where I had that first experience, the dog would just stop dead in his tracks and not go any further.
Ah.
And I would kind of keep walking down, and I'd have to call out to him, and he would just stand there and watch me, and I could, you know, just tell that he didn't want to go any further, and eventually I would kind of coax him down. But it was around the same spot where that original encounter happened.
Oh, so he remembers.
Yeah, well, I'm just wondering if, like, once he was a little bit older and a little bit more aware of his surroundings, that he actually did pick up on something, and if something was there,
yeah,
he didn't want to go anywhere near it.
Yeah,
and I did have a couple of other kind of experiences along that track. I was walking along there one day and kind of got down a little bit further, and as you go down the track, you come to this kind of rocky ledge that goes off down into a rainforest area where there's a creek that runs through it, and the type of bush changes into more of a kind of rainforest. And I was walking along there one day, and I just noticed, because you're looking down on the tops of the trees, and I just noticed one of the trees was swaying from side to side, as if something was actually down there pushing the tree from side to side.
Yeah.
And I looked around for the wind, and there was no wind. And I don't know, I just got the feeling that there was something down there, and it was like sending a warning to me.
Jeez. I take it you didn't go any further to investigate what was pushing on the tree.
No, well, I felt safe because I was kind of up this small cliff, so I gathered I was pretty safe there. But I guess, and I had one more experience along that track, so I kind of jokingly started referring to that as the Yowie track.
Yeah.
another time I kind of got towards the end of the track and walking along and about to go back up the hill, and on the other side of the hill, and it was kind of a little bit of away from me, so I kind of felt safe, but I could hear something crashing down through the bush, kind of coming down the hill towards me.
Uh-huh.
And it was, whatever it was, it was big, and you could hear the, you know, branches breaking, and it was kind of, it was coming down, and I felt like I was kind of far enough away for a bit, and then as it kept coming, I thought, yeah, it's time to get out of here now.
Yeah, I can imagine. Jeez. So have you heard from other people like around you that have had similar sort of experiences?
Yeah, I haven't actually spoke because, I mean, it's something that's kind of hard to bring up in conversation.
Up
to people.
Yeah.
But there are, having a look at reports on the web, there are quite a few people in my area that have had experiences.
Yeah.
I know that there was one guy, it was quite a few years ago, but he was driving along the highway there late at night, and he reported an 8-foot hairy creature come out and he nearly hit the thing with his car. So he came to a screeching stop, and this thing put its hands on the bonnet of the car and looked in, peered in through the window, and then ran off into the bush. And I think that was about kind of, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Jesus. Now, I don't know, the laws here in America vary by state to state, but what would happen if somebody in Australia, it's probably the same in Australia too, but what would happen in Australia if somebody were to shoot one of these yowies? Because it sounds like this place is ripe for a serious investigation and sort of on-the-ground look for the yowie. So, and you know, not to get into the shoot the kill or no kill debate, but what would be the outcome of something like that, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of these sightings actually occur in what is the Blue Mountains National Park. So you're really not allowed to be taking guns in there and shooting anyway, although I think recently the laws have just changed to allow some limited hunting in national parks. But I don't think it's anything that the authorities have really kind of given much thought to, because it's,
it's the yowie.
Except for people that are interested in, you know, cryptozoology and the unexplained, it's not really on the radar for most people. So
yeah, so you might be able to get away with it, but I wouldn't. It would be interesting.
Yeah, from a personal point of view, I'm definitely against the shoot to kill argument.
Yeah.
I'd be happy if these. If these creatures kind of stay elusive and that we don't actually, you know, end up with a body or a live specimen, I think the mystery of it is more important than actually finding a creature.
Interesting. That's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, and I know that probably goes against what a lot of people think, but if we find one and we have conclusive proof, then hey, all we've got then is, you know, another creature, really. But I quite prefer the mystery of it all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good point. You know, if we had the answer to all these mysteries, we wouldn't have anything left to talk about. So
it's
something that needs to stay a mystery. Now, another blog post that I thought was really interesting at weirdaustralia.com was this one on Devil's Pool. And you'll have to tell me more about the general, you know, location of it and whatnot. But I was really interested that there's these Aboriginal legends that surround it, while also having this contemporary issue of these mysterious deaths. So there's a lot going on here with the Devil's Pool down there in Australia. Tell me about this weird location.
Yeah, the Devil's Pool is an interesting one, Tim. It's the Devil's Pool is up in, it's just south of Cairns in far north Queensland, and it's the Devil's Pool is actually at a place where three creeks run into one, and then it's into a big pool, and then there's a couple of big boulders, and then it water kind of goes down through there and then drops off to about 50 feet below. So it's actually quite a dangerous spot to start with.
Yeah.
But there does seem to be an inordinate number of deaths at the place compared with a lot of other spots around Australia, which are probably equally as dangerous. But what's interesting about the Devil's Pool is that there's an Aboriginal legend, dreaming legend, about a young Aboriginal girl called Ulana and a handsome young man from another tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And Ulana was set to, it was arranged that she was going to marry one of the tribal elders at a time when another tribe came into the area, and she met a young man from the other tribe and they fell in love, but she was set to marry this tribal elder.
Yeah.
So what happened is that they fell in love, decided to run away so they could be together, and when they were found, they were actually found at the Binda Boulders, which is what we now know today as the Devil's Pool.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is that the tribal elders came along, found a couple there, they grabbed Ulana and grabbed her lover and separated them, and Ulana broke free and actually jumped into the pool and drowned.
Oh boy.
As a, she knew that she wouldn't be with her lover.
Yeah.
So she jumped in the pool and killed herself. And what's surprising today is that since about 1959, there has been 17 deaths at the pool.
Weird.
And interestingly, all but one of them have actually been young men that have died there. I think there was one woman, but of the other 17 reported deaths since 1959.
That's weird.
All of
yeah.
them have, or yeah, or all of them have been men, and also they were not only men, but they were also visitors to the area, so tourists. There hasn't been reports of locals actually dying, which is interesting because the Ulana's lover actually was a visitor from another tribe, so there's a connection there as well.
Yeah, and also that they, ostensibly the visitors would have no idea about the legend anyway, so it's not even like, you know, so it's an even more strange sort of thing. It's not like some subliminal, subconscious
exactly,
thing.
Exactly, yeah. So, and I guess, you know, you could account for kind of the, you know, reckless behaviour and people not taking the, the precautions that they should when swimming in you know, a dangerous area like that. But it's interesting that not all the people that have, or the men that have drowned there, have actually been swimming in the pool at the time. We had one instance where there was a young couple and they were standing together on one of the rocks and they were actually looking into the pool. And there's actually a photo just of the couple moments before a wave kind of rushes up and sweeps both of them into the water.
Oh, weird.
And the girl is lucky enough to survive, but her boyfriend is swept down into the water and is drowned.
Strange. Is that normal that there would be a wave on? Imagine that, like,
More a kind of as a surge of water coming down through the creek, I guess. But still, that's not not what you would consider a normal thing.
Yeah, that's weird. Well, we have a place here in Massachusetts, where I am in America, has a very similar sort of story, where it's like a cliff, and numerous people have died there or have been said to die there, and it's got like Native American lore attached to it. It'd be interesting to see if that's a predominant thing from other listeners and stuff. You know, folks who are listening should send their stories in about maybe every sort of area has this weird, like, legendary cliff of some kind. But this is very weird.
There's a 24-year-old, his name was Peter McGann, and he died there at the pool in 1979. And he was just jumping between two rocks, and it was just a short space, but he actually slipped and fell into the pool and went missing and was later found, drowned.
My goodness. Now they have like warnings up there and stuff now?
They have put warnings there, but it doesn't seem to deter people at all. The last recorded death that I had at the Devil's Pool was of a Tasmanian naval seaman who was visiting there. That was in 2009, and then there was a couple in around 2006. One was an Adelaide tourist. And then there was also a businessman from Sydney.
Weird.
Another interesting aspect of the Devil's Pool as well is that, according to the local Aboriginals, if you disrespect a sacred site, then bad things will happen to you. And there's actually the story of, there was one young guy there who was, he was seen to be disrespecting the area. He was actually kicking one of the plaques that commemorates one of the people who died there.
Oh, man.
Which is a pretty sick thing to do anyway.
Yeah.
And as he was kicking the plaque, he slipped and fell into the pool. Around.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow. That's karma for you, man. Yikes.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah.
Jeez. Now, what about this story of the poltergeist in the town of, I'm probably going to mess this up, but like Gyra? Is it Gura?
Gyra, yep. Gyra? You got that exactly right.
Oh, nice.
Yep. Gyra's about, probably about 3 hours west of where I'm staying right at the moment, up in the mountains in the Northern Tablelands. And I think the Gyra ghost is probably one of our, most celebrated, mysteries, I think. It's, the Gyra ghost is fairly well, it's a well-known story. And it started, strange things started happening at the house of the Bowen family
mm-hmm.
in April, back in 1921. And it all seemed to center around the Bowen's, young daughter. I think she was a young teenager at the time. It started with, the kind of usual poltergeist activity is thumping on the walls in the house, and it all seemed to center on, young Minnie Bowen.
Yeah.
Soon the thumpings it developed more into, destructive showers of stones that started raining down on the house.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and it's, these stones started raining down on the house, both from within inside the house and outside the house as well. So naturally, like the Bowen family thought that there was, somebody was actually throwing stones at the house. So, they would station themselves outside, check, but they could never find any kind of human cause for the throwing of the stones.
Yeah. What I thought was interesting, too, about the story in the blog post is that you also, within that story, there's this weird, really weird story about an elderly woman vanishing. And I was completely blown away by that. What the hell happened there?
Yeah, that was a crazy one. So just around the same time that this started happening, and I think this one that you're referring to happened just before the poltergeist activity within the house. But, there was this very strange story of farm worker seeing one of the old ladies in town, Mrs. Doran, and he noticed that she was just walking across one of the fields. She had a potato in each hand, strangely enough. And she was just walking across the paddocks, and kind of oblivious to everything that was going on. And she walked over a slight hill, and that was the last that anyone had ever seen of her. She was never seen again, and it's strange that she would be carrying a potato in each hand.
Yeah, that is odd. Do they know why she was? Do they have any idea what that was all about?
No. As much as I searched, the details were fairly scant on that one. But yes, she was reported as having a potato in each hand, walking over a hill, and was gone. And they never found her.
Weird. Now, how did the poltergeist story resolve itself? Did the activity just go away, or did
It actually got a lot worse, and it attracted quite a lot of attention. So you had a lot of the townspeople, because Gyra was a small farming community, so everyone knew what was going on there. So you had local townspeople kind of setting up a cordon around the house each night to make sure that there was nobody throwing stones. You had the local police involved, but still the stones kept falling inside the house and from outside. And interestingly, the rocks were being thrown at the policemen as well. So,
oh, weird.
If it was anybody in the local area having a, or, you know, doing this, you would think that they would be clear of throwing rocks at armed policemen.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Weird, yeah. You gotta be really off your rocker to be doing that.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. But, it continued, and, one day, so they shutted up the, because all the windows in the house ended up being broken by these stones flying around in the house, and the Bowens had boarded up all the doors and windows, and they were out working in the fields one day and come home, and all the boardings over the windows and over the doors had been ripped apart and just laying around the yard.
Jeez. So do they, now, how does it all come around to, I guess, who came to the conclusion that it was poltergeist? I guess you kind of have to, almost. You really have to.
That was an interesting one as well, because at the time it was referred to as the ghost of Gyra, but during that time, it's the first time I've ever seen mentioned in any kind of news reports anywhere of actual poltergeist activity and the actual word poltergeist used. So I think that was kind of brought into it from outside, because you actually had Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes. He became very interested in the case, and he actually sent one of his well-to-do friends who was on business in Sydney up to check out the whole story.
Interesting.
And it was, you know, it was making big news in the papers, and may have even got some international attention. And I think that's where, you know, people were starting to suggest that, hey, maybe this is poltergeist activity rather than an actual ghost. And attention soon turned to Minnie, the young daughter of the Bowens.
Yeah.
What happened is that as this was continuing, I think the police were getting they were perplexed by the whole thing, and, you know, trying to come to some kind of conclusion. And on interviewing Minnie, they got a confession out of her that she'd actually thrown some stones herself and dumped on the walls herself. So the police concluded that, hey, she's actually done some of this herself, and we don't really know why she would have done that, but the police just then concluded that, hey, the whole thing's a hoax.
Yeah.
And so the police kind of lost interest in the case, but the townspeople actually weren't convinced that it was a hoax, though, and, you know, they'd seen it firsthand. the destruction that had been caused, and a lot of the townspeople had witnessed it themselves, so they remained unconvinced. But eventually it all got too much for the Bowens, and they sent their daughter, they sent Minnie off to live with her grandmother in Glen Innes, which is another town probably an hour or so away from Gyra. And the poltergeist activity actually followed Minnie and started occurring in her grandmother's house where she was staying.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, so it seems that, and it's often said that poltergeist activity is often centred around an adolescent, and often a girl. So that seems to be the case with the Gyra ghost. And it occurred for a few more times while she was in Glen Innes at her grandmother's place, and then it just seemed to die out and stop, and the whole story just kind of faded away after that.
Odd. Yeah, that seems to be the case with some of these poltergeist stories, that it happens and it's like a flash and then it's gone. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Very
weird. Yeah, it did cause quite a stir, and then it became, especially around Australia, became quite a famous case, and other kind of Gyra ghost stories started popping up in other areas around Australia as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Quite caused some kind of hysteria in a sense, too, where you never know what.
Yeah, exactly, that's right, yeah. So, and for a while, everything that was going on was, you know, referred to as another Gyra ghost episode.
Interesting. Now, tell me about these bunyips, because you've got a post about it's called Bunyips, Serpents, and Other Creatures Lurking Beneath Our Waters. And like I had said, the name rings a bell, bunyip, but I don't think I've ever actually discussed it or explored it at length on the show here. So what is this? Is this something that's specific to Australia, or is this sort of like a creature that other people have reported elsewhere? And what is it, the bunyip?
The bunyip is more an Australian cryptid, I guess you would call it.
Yeah.
And most people in Australia have heard of bunyips and kind of have some idea of what a bunyip is, but the problem with the bunyip is that nobody can really kind of put a finger on what an actual bunyip is. There are just so many different descriptions of bunyips.
Yeah.
And it's even something that the local Aboriginals or different groups of Aboriginals kind of have different descriptions and characteristics for a bunyip. And it seems like it's kind of a catch-all for any strange animal. But, what happened back in 1847, the Australian Museum in Sydney actually put on display what they claimed the skull of a bunyip. It seems that was likely a hoax, and somebody had been having a lend of them, because the skull was on display for like 2 days and then it was quietly removed. What happened is that it got a little bit of attention in the newspapers, and then a lot of people started getting in touch with the newspapers, and in particular the Sydney Morning Herald, and started discussing their own encounters with the bunyip, and it soon became a fascination with the Australian public.
Strange. Now, you said that it's sort of like this catch-all for mysterious sea creatures, if you will, but what are some of the ways that people have described this bunyip? Because it sounds like it is sort of like just a word for sea creature, but what are some of the various creatures? Because it's very likely there's multiple different things people are seeing and calling bunyips. How do they describe them?
The bunyip seems to refer to creatures that live in what are called billabongs or water holes inland, rather than kind of being referred to creatures that, you know, may live in the ocean.
Yeah.
The bunyip has long been feared by the Aborigines, and they've had a lot of stories in their folklore about bunyips, living in billabongs and in creeks and water holes, and and they've warned their children to stay away, otherwise they'll be eaten by the bunyip.
Oh God!
And it's said to devour humans and sneaks up on them in silence. But with the descriptions, there's, as I was saying, there's a lot of different descriptions of it. There's one that has a huge body, sometimes covered in fur, sometimes in feathers.
Oh, weird.
And instead of legs, it has flippers. There was a drawing by a Murray River Aboriginal in 1848, and that depicted the bunyip as having the body of a hippopotamus and a horse-like head, while a depiction by a Victorian Aboriginal showed it with the neck and head of an emu. So it just goes to show that there's really no kind of firm... It's not like the Yowie where you can say, it's 7 to 8 feet tall and it's covered in hair and it walks upright. The bunyip is, it's a lot unclearer as to what it actually is.
Right. There's no like universal description of this thing. It sounds like we said, it's a catch all for all these different things. Now,
yeah, exactly.
In Australia nowadays, go ahead. I'm sorry.
There was another description in 1848 of it having a round head, elongated neck, and the body and tail of an ox. Another description in 1855 is a sort of half horse, half alligator lurking in the swamps and lagoons. And then another one is bigger than an elephant and the shape of a bullock with eyes like live coals and tusks like a walrus. So it's, there's a lot of different descriptions for the bunyip out there.
Yeah, so weird. Is this like a holdover to sort of less modern times? Like, do people still have like bunyip sightings nowadays, or was it something that sort of was more way back, in the 1800s, maybe early 1900s?
Yeah, it's something that was more way back. It's I've not really heard of any recent bunyip sightings. It's something that's probably most popular, probably in the late 1800s. There was a few kind of eyewitness accounts maybe into the early 1900s, but from what I understand, it wouldn't be many encounters happening now.
Yeah. Well, it's just interesting, too, from the descriptions that you have, that it's just like it's hard almost to imagine what these people are seeing because there's such bizarre descriptions. It's like combinations of animals
exactly.
That just don't make any sense. So it's so odd.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you could probably put some of it down to people just, especially in the 1800s, they're in a strange land, living in right out in the middle of nowhere, and probably a lot of people's imaginations getting the better of them as well. Hearing strange sounds of the night and just letting their imagination get the better of them, I think.
Right. Plus, you see something that's sort of like half in the water, maybe, or obscured vision, the mind fills in the gap sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And I think you could probably say eels and other kind of aquatic animals like that have probably accounted for quite a few of these bunyip stories as well.
Yeah, I don't really know much about the wildlife down in Australia aside from the obvious stuff like the kangaroo and stuff, but are there like possible like hippos or anything strange like that that might be down there that people might be considering a bunyip?
Yeah, not really, but it's funny you should say the hippo because one of our earliest explorers, I think it may have been Captain Sturt, actually, and he's a well-known Australian that kind of went into the inland. He actually reported seeing a hippopotamus-like animal in one of the rivers. I think it may have been in southern New South Wales. And I mean, there's no animal that that really kind of fits that description, but that's what he reported. So
weird. Maybe there's just some kind of like, not necessarily a hippo, but some other sort of You know, you never really hear about, this could be like a whole different kind of cryptid we don't even know about yet. So.
Yeah, I put it down to, and when you look at the Aboriginal stories, when they can't, they have different descriptions of them themselves, because with the Aborigines, they lived in the bush. They knew all the animals that lived in the bush, and they knew them intimately. So when you've got two different groups of Aboriginals that can't decide on what a bunyip is, I think it's me. I think it's something that's more in the cultural memory, perhaps from when the megafauna existed in Australia, probably 40,000-50,000 years ago, because the Australian Aboriginals, some reports put them back to 55,000-60,000 years of inhabiting Australia. So they would have been around at the same time when the megafauna roamed Australia. There could have been an overlap of about 4,000 or 5,000 years when these really large animals existed at the same time as the early Aboriginals.
Yeah, that's true. And then it could just get passed down, over the years where...
Yeah, exactly. And, so over, thousands and thousands of years, these stories of were probably real animals that existed at one time. The stories keep getting passed down and it evolves into these differing descriptions of what a bunyip is.
Now, we said it's sort of like more of a, I'll say, classic phenomenon, if you will, and you don't really know of any modern sightings. So I guess it's not really something that... So I know there are people down there who are, like, into Yowie research and Yowie hunts, and, isn't there a guy called the Yowie Hunter or something like that down in Australia?
Yeah, there's a couple of... There's a guy called Dean Harrison. There's, Tim the Yowie Man.
Yowie Man, that was it, yeah. Yeah, I guess what I was going to say is, like, is there anyone, like, really specifically focusing in on the bunyip, or has it kind of, like, been accepted as sort of this collective, like I said, classic creature that really isn't a part of the modern cryptozoological milieu, if you will?
I think it's pretty widely, left as being one of those more ecological kind of animals, I guess.
Yeah. Now, you have a big post there also on Canberra, which is Australia's capital, and all the weird stuff surrounding it. Talk about this situation with Lake George and how the waters disappear and then reappear, and there's no real discernible reason for why that happens. Because I thought that's something that's, you talk about like a Yowie sighting or a UFO sighting or something like that. That's kind of dependent on whoever's there and whoever sees it at the time and stuff. But like, all the water of a lake disappearing and then coming back, that's clearly something that everyone can see and can look at, and there's no doubt that it happens. So, I mean, it's more of a natural phenomena, perhaps. I guess just talk about that, because it's so weird.
Yeah, so Lake George, a lot of people in southeastern Australia would know Lake George. It's actually on the main highway between Sydney and our capital, Canberra.
Mm-hmm.
It is very strange. I've driven past it many times myself, and I've usually seen it, and especially probably for the last 10-15 years, I guess, where there's been a drought, that the lake is kind of virtually empty. And then other times you'll drive past and there's a lot more water in there, and it doesn't necessarily correspond to rainfall the area at that time.
Yeah.
When explorers first started moving into that area and exploring it, it was actually described as an inland sea with waves and actually quite deep. But you drive past it now, and one thing you'll notice, as you drive along the road, it's like a big open plain. And it's being used for grazing sheep and cattle. You'll see fence lines going across out into the lake. where farmers have claimed the land when there's been absolutely no water in it. And then you'll see when the lake reappears, you'll see these fence lines going out through the water where the ground had once been bare dry. So, yeah, the water definitely comes and goes.
Weird.
And that's clear for everyone to see. And nobody knows exactly where the water goes or where it comes from. I mean, there's lots of different theories, but no one's actually proven anything.
Is it like a slow transition, or was it sort of happen within like a year? Is it like, from...
It can happen quite fast, probably, I'm guessing, but, within months rather than... It's not actually a slow kind of rise or a slow fall. It can happen quite quickly.
Weird. That's why it's called Weird Australia, folks.
There's actually been a lot of other kind of weird activity associated with Lake George as well, with UFO sightings and, ghosts on the highway. And it's just a very weird, strange area with a very strange vibe about it.
And in that post on Canberra, you also talk about these underground tunnels and bases, which I thought was pretty interesting. You mentioned this place called the Sheep Paddock. I mean, as you say in the post, it's like a lot of these cities do have underground tunnels and stuff that were built way back in the day. But it almost sounds like there's a suspicion, maybe. I don't know if that's the right word, but a theory or a concept that there's maybe more of a vastness beneath Canberra than the regular folks seem to think.
Yeah, well, there are, you're right, Tim, there are a lot of tunnels and a lot of underground buildings in Canberra, and I think that was probably a result of a lot of Canberra would have been built during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have a lot of underground bunkers and, there's tunnels leading from, one government building to the next. They're actually not all that secret, and you do hear public servants talking about, how they can walk from building A to building B and underground, and, it saves them from getting wet when it's raining or, when it's really cold.
Right.
There are a lot of rumours about a lot more secretive underground bases or underground tunnels and bunkers and that in Canberra. And Canberra has all the, the diplomatic missions in Australia as well. So there's obviously a lot of spying going on. And one of the main suspicions is that there's a place called the Black Mountain Tower in Canberra. And it's a famous landmark down there. You can see it from pretty much wherever you are in Canberra. And there's a lot of stories coming out of there that's used as a centre for spying on diplomatic missions, particularly the Chinese. And it's interesting that there was a news report on our national broadcaster, the ABC, quite a few years back, with a technician who gave an interview on the, he was a whistleblower and talking about spying on the Chinese embassy from the Black Mountain Tower. And that news report was, the government put what they call, a denotice.
Yeah.
On that article, which meant that it was forbidden from ever being published again. So,
oh wow!
I tried to find that on YouTube and the interview, but it's not anywhere to be seen.
Jeez, that's odd. I didn't know they could do that sort of thing, but I guess it's sort of different down there. It's like a state secret sort of act type of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly, that's right. But and there's other buildings. There's the Deakin Telephone Exchange, which is supposedly being used to espionage or for espionage purposes, and even talk about the FBI and the NSA using that building. And then, as you said, there's in Belconnen, one of the suburbs in Canberra, there's what they call the sheep paddock, and that's just a, it is actually a paddock with sheep in it, and there's a little kind of, almost like just a little shed out in the paddock, where, which is supposed to be the nondescript entrance to a major underground command centre.
Jeez. Well, it would stand to reason. I mean, if Canberra is the capital of Australia, there's got to be, like you said, if it was built in the Cold War and the whole idea of, like, continuance of government and that kind of thing, it would stand to reason that they would need a pretty formidable escape area, if you will. So it kind of makes
exactly.
sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, I've heard kind of conspiracy theories that there are, you know, there are whole cities built underneath Canberra that, you know, that are being used by the New World Order for, all that kind of thing. But, you know, I mean, you have to take that kind of thing with a grain of salt, I think. And, you never know, there could be, but, one of the things with these underground bases is that you're never going to get to the truth, you know, no matter how hard you try.
Exactly, yeah.
There's even, there's a researcher, who I mentioned before, Rex Gilroy, who was the, guy that kind of brought the whole Yowie phenomenon back into the spotlight. And he's gone on to research a lot of other things as well. And he claims that there's a deep underground base actually in the Blue Mountain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, where they're, you know, testing, you know, all these top secret aircraft, and because there are a lot of UFO sightings in the Blue Mountains as well. And, yeah, he's claiming there's a deep underground base there, but it's one of those things, you know, I guess it's like the Dulce base in, New Mexico, is it?
Yeah, New Mexico, yeah.
Yeah, you know, how are you ever going to prove anything like that? And I guess the hard part that I can't understand or find hard to fathom with a deep or a massive underground base in the Blue Mountains is, you know, if you're making a base like that, you've got to dig out a lot of earth and you've got to move that earth somewhere, and that would be hard to hide, so.
Yeah, it's like, where'd all that stuff go? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And then also it's, we have Warragamba Dam there in the Blue Mountains. So there's a massive catchment area for all of Sydney's drinking supply. So I just find it kind of hard to believe that you would have a secret military installation hidden in. It's not only a national park, it's a World Heritage listed area, and it's also, you know, contains all of Sydney's drinking supply. So,
weird.
Interesting story, though.
When you talk about these sort of secret bases and stuff, you got to mention the one that seems to be the most famous to us here in America, which is the Pine Gap facility over there in Australia. A lot of people think, we'll call that the Area 51 of Australia. And there's all kinds of, like, rumor and innuendo attached to that. What do you know or think about the this Pine Gap area?
Yeah, Pine Gap's a funny one. That's again, it's hard to know what is fact and what is fiction about Pine Gap. It's kind of slap bang in the middle of Australia, outside of Alice Springs, and it's a it's a desolate area, but, you know, I've heard stories that there's whole, you know, underground cities there, and, you know, they're testing black triangles and all the usual conspiracy theory that that you hear about. But again, I just find it hard to, I just don't think they could hide something that at large, you know, the Pine Gap base, it's fact that, you know, it's there, it's used by the US military to, for spying purposes around the world. But, some of the stories about, deep underground cities there with testing UFO-type aircraft. Yeah, I just kind of find that a bit hard to fathom.
Well, one of the weird, I've heard people go so far as to say that Pine Gap is, you know, like a joint alien U.S. or joint alien human base, or the aliens use Pine Gap, or, I've heard, it's interesting, I don't know if you've ever heard this, I forget exactly who said it, I think maybe a remote viewer or something, said like there's four bases on the planet for aliens, and one of them is in Australia, and it might be Pine Gap, I forget if he said that specifically, but I've heard it said that there's like an alien base in Australia.
I've heard that too, but it's hard to place much credence in stories like that. In the Northern Territory where Pine Gap is based, there are a lot of weird things happening there, and you know, there are a lot of credible UFO sightings in the area. But you know, to start talking about alien bases and that kind of thing, it makes for interesting stories, but you know, for me anyway, that's kind of as far as it would go.
Exactly. Yeah, we can't do much about it. I'm sure they're not going to, you know, I'm sure you're not going to get very close to an alien base if you decide to venture out that way, as it is.
Exactly. I mean, it's hard enough for an Australian politician to gain access to Pine Gap, so there's not much hope of finding out what really goes on there.
Exactly, yeah. This is like America's Area 51. They don't let, like, anybody
in there. Yeah, exactly. That's right, yeah.
Battery you can buy. You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Mate, you wouldn't read about it in the bulletin fitting. What I've got here is some genuine Australian kangaroo tail soup. Get some of this into the digger. Look at that, eh? How about that? Cooked to be so.
$3 is pretty doggone good there, Jeff, my son.
Tell me, Bruno, you ever eat any food like that?
No, I must admit that I've never eaten Australian
kangaroo tail soup.
Kangaroo tail.
I wonder what
that's
part
what it's made out of.
What part of the tail, Jess?
I don't know.
Probably the part the kangaroo sits on, right?
I have no idea.